John, first of all, just thank you so much for taking some time and stopping by the studio this morning. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me here.
And what we do want to talk about this morning, of course, is mental health in schools, essentially, sort of a broad topic, but more specifically, some efforts to address what some of those problems are. And I guess maybe just to sort of start off, I know you've been working in this sort of realm for a long time. And maybe if you could just give us kind of a snapshot of sort of how this notion of when we think about mental health in schools, the need for counseling in schools, what students' needs are in those terms, how that's sort of changed over the last, you know, couple of decades.
Sure. I think if you start by, and I've been doing this for, this is my 26th year in education, my 14th here in Alaska, and I was a school administrator and a teacher in the state of Maine prior to coming here. If you look at the family structures as a starting point from 25, 26 years ago to today, there's been a dramatic change in what the, quote, you know, typical or traditional family looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that to, in any way, shape, or form, you know, shame, you know, a non-traditional family with a father and a, you know, a mother and, you know, a stable income. But we have seen in society family structures change significantly. We have a lot more single parents due to the opioid epidemic. We are seeing a lot more grandparents who have already raised children and are now at a stage of their lives where they're pretty tired.
Sure.
Are having now to step up and fill the vacuum and provide care and be that person for grandchildren. So family structures, what's going on in society in terms of drug addiction, increased levels of sexual abuse, domestic violence, kids today are not experiencing to the extent that families and children had to, you know, experience those traumatic experiences in their lives than 25 years ago.
Trauma, to me, seems to be one of the very key words here because, as you and I were discussing before we went on the air, this idea of being able to sort of define what these things are when you have, as a student, if you have something happen in your life, just simply defining that as traumatic and understanding what the impacts of that situation are, that's also changed very rapidly. And certainly folks have a lot of opinions about that, but maybe you could address that just in terms of our ability to sort of identify and define some of these things.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the research has come a long ways. In 20, 25 years as well, in terms of understanding now the impact that childhood trauma has on that individual. And there's a term called ACEs, which I'll define for the audience here. Is an ACE is an adverse childhood experience. And what that means is a very traumatic experience that occurs in an individual's life prior to the age of 18 that was so impactful that it impacts that individual pretty much for the rest of their life on into adulthood. And there are different types of ACEs. There are three categories of ACEs: abuse, neglect, and general household dysfunction are the three general categories of what an ACE is. And obviously, in the abuse category, we could be talking either emotional abuse, physical abuse, or sexual abuse. Neglect can be both physical and emotional. Neglect, you know, the withholding needed medical attention or not having heat in the house, proper clothing, not enough food, always worried about where that next meal is coming from.
Right, the basics.
The basics. Maslow's
right.
Pyramid.
Right.
And then household dysfunction comes under the guise of if students are living in or a child is living in a household where there's domestic violence or abuse going on or there's some sexual abuse or that there's an individual in the household who has been incarcerated Those are some of the categories under the household dysfunction.
My notion or my sort of first thought about this would be that dysfunction category likely is the part of this that's grown a lot, just because it is so broad and it encompasses so many different sort of variables that a child might have to navigate growing up in, you know, just as a matter of being at home when they're not at school. That dysfunction aspect of it is probably one of the more challenging things to address, but maybe not so much to identify, or maybe it is a little bit more difficult to identify just because it is so broad and kind of nebulous sometimes. I don't know.
Well, I'd say we've had the dysfunction that's occurring and the trauma that's occurring among our families here on the Kenai Peninsula, and you know, if you extrapolate that to Alaska in general, we pride ourselves here in Alaska as being number one in a lot of different categories. You know, we're the biggest state. We have the lowest tax burden.
Prettiest.
We have the tallest mountains.
That's right.
And those are things for us to be proud of. You know, as Alaskans, we take great pride in that. But
The flip side
and the sad side is that we're also either number one or near the top in some pretty dubious distinctions, such as domestic violence against women, sexual abuse against children, and, you know, the number of individuals who are addicted to either alcohol and or some other form of drug, including opioids.
I wonder, you know, sometimes in defining some of these things, and as the definitions change and as our capacity to recognize them and sort of accept them as well, that changes as well. Do you find sort of generationally that there's some tug there, a little bit of, well, you know, this has always been a problem, and what's the big deal now? My sense is that there is at least a little bit of that out there.
Yeah, I think back in, quote, the day, we were a society that didn't want to talk openly about suicide. Mm-hmm. Suicide was very taboo. And I think to some extent, even today, it's difficult for people to talk about that.
Yeah.
There was a tremendous amount of shame involved in addiction, or shame involved in had you been the victim of sexual abuse. I think today there's a greater openness, willingness, and need, and an understanding of the need to have those topics be out in the open. And we understand the brain science now that when an individual, particularly when they are young, experience trauma, regardless of what that trauma is, it changes the wiring in their brain. It impacts their ability to learn, to maintain focus. Their attention levels go down. So we understand the brain science a little more. And, you know, from the school's perspective, as a system, expectations certainly haven't gone down in terms of us, all students will graduate, ready for life, college
right.
and career. We're going to get all of our students on the SAT and ACT to a certain level, on the PEAKS state assessment, you know, for math and reading. Those expectations haven't gone down. As a matter of fact, they've gone up.
Certainly, yeah.
But at the same time, the impacts that we're seeing from trauma, we have to work doubly hard to make sure that we're providing resources and counseling services for our students in order to become resilient and to gain those coping skills that they are going to need to be successful for the rest of their lives.
And that's part of it, too, that sort of all ties in together when we think about what has changed in terms of the expectations of a student and what the education system is ostensibly preparing them for, much different than it was even 15, 20 years ago. And it's much more dynamic. You're preparing them for a much more dynamic world where, you know, that one job for 30 years isn't going to be there. Those stable situations, unfortunately, maybe we're not going to count on that. And there's a little bit of darkness sort of in knowing that you're preparing for a future like that, but it's sort of the reality of it.
It is, and I, you know, I like to consider myself an optimist.
You kind of have to be.
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing some incredible things in the district in preparing our students to be ready for 21st century living. Because you're right. I grew up in the state of Maine. And if you could get a job at one of the paper mills,
sure,
you were actually making more than the teachers and many of the lawyers and professionals that were working in the professional fields. And you could count on that job for the next 30 years, and chances are you could count on getting your son or daughter, into the paper industry, and things were fine, or the same shoe factories, those manufacturing.
Yeah, the blue-collar sorts of jobs that could support that, as you were talking about earlier, that more traditional sort of family structure, those blue-collar jobs that don't demand so much education and so much investment on the front end, those are much, much more difficult to come by. Yeah.
Right. Now it's all about educating students to be versatile, to be problem solvers, to be resilient. There's a lot of talk about grit. And if you have two individuals, both with the same, relatively the same level of skills or expertise, mm-hmm. and talents, the individual that is more resilient and that doesn't let a setback crush them is going to be the one who is more successful. So in schools where we're doing a lot of work with our students on positive mindsets, growth mindsets, being resilient and having grit, but also being able to get along and work collaboratively with others. And even though you don't necessarily like that individual, we all know that in our jobs, when we're put together on a project or a task, it's not about whether you like those individuals. It's about completing the project successfully so that you're forwarding the goals of your company or organization.
I see sort of generic, not to get off on too much of a tangent, I see sort of generic headlines from time to time that suggest that maybe younger generations of students, millennials and on down, do prefer a little bit of group work because there is a little bit of feedback, there's some support there. In a world where we are isolated all the time, doing some group work provides some distinction from that isolation. I mean, I don't know, is there anything to that?
Yeah, well, having been in the business for as long as I have, most of our new hires now are indeed millennials.
That's right.
And I'm blessed to be the father of three daughters who are all millennials. And absolutely, what a millennial brings into the workforce, there are good things about that and bad things about it. They definitely want to see that they're making a positive impact immediately. There's a little less patience for waiting for that than perhaps my generation or your generation. But at the same time, passion for doing good, that's why I'm very optimistic about the future, because I believe our millennials truly value their communities and want to make a positive impact in their communities and in the world.
Yeah. John O'Brien joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. He's the Assistant Superintendent of Instruction. We're talking about sort of broadly and in general to start the show this morning, talking about mental health concerns in our public schools and some of the things that administrators and educators have been able to identify more recently that maybe in years past were a little bit more under the radar, and understanding a little bit better of how some of those variables that students face affect things in the classroom. And sort of getting down, John, into some more specific things, one of the things we hear so much about and has been such an ongoing problem now for a generation, and especially in Alaska, as you pointed out, this is one of the areas where we do pretty well when we would rather not. We talk a lot about opioid addiction. And I'm curious if a student dealing with that in the home, regardless of how that sort of manifests itself in the home, dealing with that manifests itself in the classroom, if that's different than any other sort of trauma or sort of bump in the road that kids have to deal with, do those things all come into the classroom sort of in the same way, or does it really depend on what exactly is going on at home and outside the classroom as to how things go inside the classroom?
Yeah, so good question. Just because a lot of these issues are occurring outside of the school surely doesn't mean that once they get off the school bus and come through those front doors that students are able to compartmentalize that and it's not impacting them during the day. I mentioned a little bit earlier, the science is very clear now. There's a lot of research on impact on students who are affected by trauma. It really impacts their daily attention, their memory, reduces their ability to focus and organize and process information. It inhibits their ability to be effective problem solvers. And by problem solvers, I don't just mean by, a word problem in math. If they're having a conflict, whether it's with a peer, a group of peers, or a teacher, problem solving means your ability to navigate that and come up with an appropriate solution to that problem. And unfortunately, we're seeing more and more of our students who are lashing out and are behaving inappropriately, and that leads to suspensions or to violence in a school. So that's an issue. And obviously anyone who's experienced trauma, there's a lot of anxiety involved in that. And getting their homework done or doing well on that that end of chapter test really isn't as important to that student as dealing with that trauma. And on the flip side of that, on the extreme end, we have two indicators in the district that we track on a daily basis and obviously over time, and those are the number of students that we're having to conduct suicide threat assessments on because they're expressing a desire to harm themselves or to commit suicide, and then also the number of the Office of Children Services referrals that we're seeing for suspected or known abuse and neglect. And, data going back, that I have going back to the 2013-2014 school years, we've seen increases over the last 3 to 4 years. Last year, unfortunately, was a record year for us in the number of suicide threat assessments that we had to perform on students and the number of OCS referrals. This year, we're only about halfway through the year, and we're on pace to, in some cases, double those numbers. So very alarming. That's why we're working with trying to implement elementary counselors and
right.
additional mental health supports in our schools.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that because I know that, as we're in sort of budget talks, that portion of the year where we're talking about how we're going to fund schools and what the priorities are, and lots in the headlines lately regarding at least the governor's thoughts on funding schools. Maybe we could talk a little bit about, I guess what I'm curious about, I want to talk about what role the counselors play in this. But maybe for folks who aren't familiar with all this kind of stuff, or you haven't had kids in school for a while, when we talk about what is a suicide threat assessment, what are these OCS referrals? Maybe we could talk a little bit about what those mean. What is that process to sort of dive into this and address these things at the school level?
Sure. Let's start with the Office of Children Services.
Okay.
As educators, we're mandated reporters. So anytime there's a suspicion of or known neglect or abuse of a child, by law, we are mandated to report that to the Office of Children Services. And those cases range from, neglect, where students are not having their basic needs met, or they're not coming to school on a regular basis, and that's going to have some negative impacts on their ability to be successful
right.
In the future. All the way up to, unfortunately, severe cases of sexual abuse or physical abuse.
And we're talking about things that at first blush seem like very sort of adult, grown-up problems, and I'm sure that this does not just happen to kids in high school. This is probably going all the way down to the very lowest elementary grades for some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Our suicide threat assessment ratio from secondary to elementary is skewed higher towards secondary students.
Sure.
But if you look at our Office of Children Services referrals, mm-hmm. it almost flips at that point, and we have more elementary-based OCS referrals than we do secondary-based. The problem that we have with that is that historically, we have provided counselors at the high school level and at the middle school level based on a formula. We staff counselors at the high school level at 250 to 1. So for every 250 students at one of our larger high schools, there's one counselor provided. So most of our schools, our larger high schools, have between, you know, 1.5 and 2 counselors. And our middle schools typically have 1 counselor. But at the elementary level, I've been in the district for 14 years, and we've never funded counselors at the elementary level, which to me is counterintuitive, because if we can deal with some of these social-emotional needs at the elementary level, we might see fewer manifestations of those traumatic experiences at the secondary level. So for the past couple of years, we've really been working hard to try to increase funding from the borough to be able to provide elementary level counselors. We were close to doing that last summer, before the start of the school year. The borough assembly, by one vote, came shy of overturning the mayor's veto to provide us with an additional $600,000 that would have allowed us to begin implementing the program. And unfortunately, this year, as we go into our budget season, we've been informed by the mayor that the district can expect less money from his recommendation to the borough assembly for school funding than we received this year. We're hopeful that we can communicate directly with the borough assembly and express to them the dire need that we have in our schools for counselors. And I just recently did a presentation at a joint school board borough assembly work session on this very topic, adverse childhood experiences, and what we're doing in schools to try to address that, and how extra counselors at the elementary level would really be beneficial to our students and help us achieve our mission as a school district.
Yeah. Are there other places, you're talking about this in terms of a program, are there other places where we can look to that have developed early elementary counseling and were able to see sort of over time some impacts that's had, what that looks like over time?
Yeah, I can, you know, a lot of districts, particularly in the lower 48, they do provide counseling and or social workers at all levels, not just at the secondary levels. And in those districts, those counselors are not just dealing with the acute, immediate crises. They're implementing proactive programming where they're actually teaching students who have experienced trauma how to overcome those and to have coping mechanisms. They're doing lots of social emotional learning aspects and infusing those into some of the work that they're doing in the classroom that a teacher who's a content area specialist don't have the expertise that these social workers and or social and mental health counselors have. So It's kind of like, and our teachers are dealing with this. We provide an extensive amount of training, through online learning modules and workshops for students on, being trauma, for teachers on being trauma engaged and aware of the trauma that students are, and some techniques that they can try to incorporate into their daily working with students. But it's kind of like asking a math major to, teach language arts. They can do a fairly decent job at it, but that's not their area of expertise.
Right. And that's something else that I'm curious about. We've talked about how so many other things have changed, in terms of our ability to define, what students are going through and how that impacts things in the classrooms. My notion would be that the role of the counselor has changed probably just as much as everything else over the intervening years. Because when I think back to my own admittedly very limited experience, you certainly understood that there were counselors available or a counselor available, and that, if things were going wrong, yes, that's an option. Wasn't usually weren't a whole lot of people in that person's office until it was time to sign up for college classes. That's not what we're dealing with in 2019.
Interesting that you say that, because yeah, when a lot of people think back to their high school experience, the guidance counselor was an academic counselor.
That's right.
Not the person who you went to if you were, you know, having an emotional breakdown or you just witnessed, you know, something terrible at home.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, the role of counselors have evolved. As a matter, and our higher education programs that prepare counselors, they've actually modified their programs now. It used to be very, very heavy, almost predominant, the curriculum for counselors on academic counseling, college, career ready. Now what we're finding is the new counselors that we are hiring in the district are coming from programs that are almost 50-50 based on social, emotional, mental health, and also the academic counseling. And that's certainly where the major needs that we're seeing are in our schools right now.
I know the district employs specifically some school psychologists. Is that different than a counselor, and how is that different, and what is it different in qualification or just in job duty or what?
Yeah, vastly different qualifications and job duty. Our school psychologists actually work for our pupil services department. And are involved in the special education process. So when a student is referred for special education because there's suspicion of a learning disability or some other cognitive or behavioral disability, the primary function of our school psychologists are to lead the individual education planning team, the IEP team, in determining whether or not that student meets the eligibility criteria for a certain disability and under what category that falls under. So a lot of what our school counselors are doing through the pupil services department is in the area of assessing students in terms of what they qualify for. That being said, they also have been called upon to step up and assist us in the suicide threat assessment process, and you know, in some social emotional learning groups. Not every school has a counselor, as I shared, especially at the elementary level. So at the elementary level, our school psychologists sometimes have to step up into that role. And as you can well imagine, any time we're doing a suicide threat assessment, that entire process takes, in some cases, up to 4 hours, half a day, sometimes leading into the evening. So it's a very time-consuming event.
Walk us through what that process is like. I mean, I know it's tough to get into specific cases, but in general, what that process entails and what each step sort of does.
Yeah, so anytime a staff member is notified that there's a student who is considering self-harm or suicide.
And that could come from, I would imagine, a social media post, or another student gives the tip, or perhaps behaviors could set that off.
Yeah, I'd say probably more than half of the time it's a concerned friend who is really worried about, you know, their friend who has just told them that they don't want to be here anymore. Maybe that child has given away some very important belongings of theirs and of saying, you know, I won't need these anymore.
Yeah.
You've been a great friend. Luckily, we do a lot of training and intervention with our students to when they recognize that a friend of theirs or they are feeling desperate. We ask those students to not narc on their friend, but to be a real friend and step up and help save their lives. So
right.
I'd say probably half of the suicide threat assessments that we become aware of that we have to complete are from friend referrals. And obviously some from social media, some directly from a student that's crying out for help.
Right.
So once we are aware that that's the case, either the school principal, a counselor, or a school psychologist, or a combination of those two, sometimes we like to team that process, we'll actually sit down with the student, and we have a very specific protocol in the district that individuals, our professionals, can follow with a series of questions, next steps. You know, if the student answers yes here, do this. It's a very well-tuned protocol that also involves involving the parents or the guardians, and then a follow-up plan after that. Oftentimes we're having the students sign a contract saying that they agree not to harm themselves. Oftentimes we're referring the parent to immediately take that child to a mental health provider or to the emergency room if they don't have their own counselor or mental health provider.
Mm-hmm.
And then before the student comes back, we develop a return to school plan to monitor that child to make sure that we've got supports in place and that they're not going to fall through the cracks. So it's a very time-intensive, very well spelled out process.
And then, yeah, you mentioned there being sort of a comeback process and monitoring, and that in itself is time intensive too, to make sure that there's follow up. What can that entail?
Well, it might entail a daily check in with a student, or if we're concerned that, you know, a student's been bringing razor blades to school and are cutting themselves, it might entail a book bag search, you know, when the student gets off the bus or comes to school every morning.
Mm-hmm.
It usually identifies at least two adults in the school, upwards to three or four, where that student people that student feels comfortable going to if they're having a hard time, because, you know, as adults we get sick, or sometimes we're on training and we're not in the school.
Right.
So we always have to have that another adult in the school that's identified in that plan that child feels comfortable going to when they're crying out for help and you know, feeling like they're going to want to hurt themselves.
Yeah, and these are things that I'm guessing as teachers are new expectations on teachers, or relatively new expectations on teachers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And teachers, you know, we all went into the teaching profession because we care deeply about our students. Yeah, it's okay to sometimes put the homework aside and say it doesn't matter. We got to take care of these needs first. And our teachers do a phenomenal job with that. However, they do have lots of expectations and pressures placed upon them. So that's why we really do have a need for some additional mental health services and counseling counselors within our schools.
Very good. John O'Brien is with us this morning on the Kenai Conversation, Assistant Superintendent of Instruction for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. And we will get into, we're down to right around the bottom of the hour here, so I think it's time to take a quick little break, recharge the coffees and that sort of thing. And we'll get back and we'll talk a little bit about potentially what this new program might look like and some of the things that are being debated in terms of need for more counselors and more attention to mental health in our schools. Is that all coming up on the second half of the show? Going to take a quick break. Stay with us. And welcome back to the Kenai Conversation. Thanks for sticking with us this morning. Again, talking with John O'Brien. He's the Assistant Superintendent of Instruction at the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, and mental health in our schools, the overarching topic this morning. But wanted to, as we kick into the second half of the show here, talk a little bit about what the district has suggested it needs, or said that it needs, in terms of extra counseling. And John, I guess we touched on this a little bit in the first half of the program, this idea that there is a need for more counseling, especially in those elementary grades, the younger grades. I guess maybe if you could sort of walk us through what this program looks like, where those counselors would go, what their sort of duties would be, and what the expectations would be, and sort of outcomes that would be looked for.
Sure. I'll start with two of our Project Aware counselors. Several years ago, I think it was a four or five year grant we got through the state of Alaska and the federal government, where we were able to place two specially trained mental health counselors in our alternative schools. So we currently have, and have had for the past 5 years, four or five years, a counselor at Kenai Alternative here in the Central Peninsula, and a mental health counselor at Homer Flex Alternative School down in Homer. And those counselors have received specialized training in helping students through crisis situations, helping them with coping skills, dealing with a lot of those basic needs that are necessary for a lot of our students who are at risk in our alternative schools to be successful. Those grants were very specific that those counselors could only serve students at Kenai Alternative and Homer Flex. Well, that grant goes away at the end of the school year, unfortunately. And we are committed because we've invested in those two counselors. They've done such incredible work, not only with our students, but in providing professional learning and professional development to our administrators, other counselors, and to our teachers, that we have put those two in the budget for next year. But we're going to expand the scope or the span of control where they're working. They won't just be working at Kenai Alternative and Home Reflex anymore. They'll also be branching out to provide some assistance at some of our other secondary schools. So that's the first step that we're taking in mm-hmm. our new our mental health, addressing mental health needs in our schools. The elementary counselors that we've been talking about, as a starting point, what we're talking about is hiring 4 behavioral health or mental health counselors that would be placed and work with students at the elementary level. Because right now, as we shared earlier, we don't have any counseling services at the elementary level. So we're looking at placing 2 of those, if we were to get funding from the borough to meet this need. We would place 2 of those in the Central Peninsula area. We would place 1 in the Eastern Penn, which would cover all of Seward schools, Moose Pass, Cooper Landing, Hope, and other, nearby areas if necessary, and 1 down in the Southern Peninsula based out of somewhere in the Homer area that would mm-hmm. service elementary schools from Ninilchik on down.
Right.
Obviously, we have a denser population here in the Central Penn. That's why we're placing 2. These 4 counselors will not be able to be full-time in any one of our elementary schools. So they'd be based out of probably the school that we identify as having the greatest need or the greatest population. Mm-hmm. But then there would be a schedule put in place where they would be going to schools on a rotating basis. Or if they were...
As needed.
You've got a student who is in crisis, they may need to cancel something at the school they're at in order to go attain that. So that's our first step in wanting to address these needs. Ideally, we could place a mental health counselor in each of our schools or at least our larger elementary schools. We're also working very closely, continue to work very closely with a couple of community partners, Seaview and Homer. Seaview and Seward.
In Seward, yeah.
They're working with us, and they do have a counselor that comes in from time to time and works with some of our students there. Peninsula Central Health Services, we're working with them on potentially trying to hire a licensed clinical social worker and then have that person based out of one of our elementary schools. We were close to getting there, and then there was some turnover in administration at PCHS and some budgetary concerns that have come from some of their funding sources. So that's unfortunately had to be put on hold. But we also work with Kenaitse right here locally, and we're looking at expanding some of the services that they're providing. Particularly, I just met with them yesterday. They do a behavioral health club at Skyview Middle School, and they saw the presentation that I did to the Borough Assembly and immediately reached out to me and said, can we try to expand this to some of our other schools in the Central Peninsula?
So right.
we're excited that we can also leverage some of our community partners in order to help with this mental health, behavioral health issue.
I'm glad you brought up that the angle of trying to find some community partners for this, because I know as this discussion has happened sort of administratively and during work sessions and those sorts of things, one thing that's popped up, especially in regards to trying to team up with PCHS, with Peninsula Community Health Services, is it's not as if you can just go to the store and pick up as many mental health professionals as you want. It's a fairly specialized thing that you're going after and that PCHS is going after as well, trying to find folks to fill some of these roles. And is recruitment difficult for some of this stuff? As things get more specialized?
Yeah, it will be. Excuse me. When we were working with PCHS on that particular licensed clinical social worker, they had a very limited applicant pool. I think when we were getting close, there were maybe 3 applications, only 1 or 2 of which actually met the criteria. So as you can well imagine, if we go out and also post some positions next year. I'm sure that it's going to be difficult to recruit all of those licensed clinical social workers or counselors. But we'll work collaboratively with our community partners so that we're not necessarily competing for the same candidates.
Yeah, I wanted to get in a little bit in talking about sort of deploying additional resources in terms of addressing mental health needs at the elementary level. At that age, we talked a little bit about counselors maybe in middle school and high school being able to impart and teach coping skills and those sorts of things. At the elementary level, is it more reactive? Is it more identification and sort of keeping tabs on all the things that are going on in a student's life and how that's affecting in the classroom? Or, at what point do you start getting into some of the coping things and how to deal with those things? Because, at the elementary age, a second grader is going to have a hard time simply processing what's going on, let alone looking forward to how to make it better.
Yeah, I think at the elementary level, our focus would be on proactive and building skills. But we would also, on a case-by-case basis, deal with those acute crisis situations. As I mentioned earlier, if we can help students at a young age develop the coping skills, we're not going to change what their home situation is.
Right.
But what we can change is give them and empower them with the skills necessary to cope with the trauma that they've experienced so that they can minimize the negative impact on their learning and their life thereafter.
Does that look like, teaching kids that, first of all, that it's okay that these things are happening? Is it teaching kids to communicate what they're feeling a little bit better and teaching them how to reach out and those sorts of things? What does that look like?
Great question. And I'll start with a disclaimer that I am not a trained counselor.
Right.
I was a social studies major in college and also got a second certification in special education, and then obviously my administrative credentials. So,
kind of an armchair counselor.
Right. So then perhaps we could do a part two of this interview where we actually invite one of our Project Aware
that would be great
to come
sure.
in to talk about that. But from my limited counseling experience on what
sure.
that would look like is there would be groups set up, probably identified by a school's intervention team. Each of our schools has a RTI team, a response to intervention team, that meets on a weekly basis. They would identify students who are having issues behaviorally, socially, and we would identify certain groups of students where this behavioral health counselor would come in and actually use a curriculum specific to addressing the needs and or shortfalls that those students need to build some coping and grit skills.
Yeah. That's a good term. That's just sort of some it's not really all that acceptable to tell someone who's going through something to just tough it out, but toughing it out is a skill that maybe early enough along in the process can be sort of built in a little bit. Is that too far off base?
No, absolutely. And toughing it out isn't just toughing it out. It's understanding what positive activities, behaviors, or habits of mind an individual can employ to help them tough it out. Because as you said, just telling a student to be tough it out, there's nothing they can do, may sound good, but unless you teach that student those coping mechanisms directly through direct instruction and practice, that's not going to manifest in any change behavior on the part of the student. So that's really where the experts in behavioral health that are trained in that area would be able to identify what those groups will be
right.
working on specifically.
Right. John O'Brien, again, joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. He's the Assistant Superintendent of Instruction for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, and we've been spending this hour talking about mental health in schools and the needs of students and how those things have changed over the years. And I know it's tough to get into real specifics and on a case-by-case basis, but I think it's important for folks, again, who maybe don't have a direct relationship with the school district or have students in school, to get some sense of what kind of comes across your desk on a day-to-day basis. And maybe if you could give us some examples of some of the things that you've seen in terms of what students are actually dealing with and some of the baggage that they're bringing to school with them sometimes.
Right. Well, I'm that person that typically is the first call for a principal or a counselor at
John, what do we do? School.
Yeah, we've got this situation going on. So, you know, that might range from a student who is expressing desire to harm themselves, or it might be an actual threat that's occurred in a school. So any Office of Children's Services referral that is made, or any suicide threat assessment or behavior threat assessment that's done at a school, every day my administrative assistant puts all of those in a folder, whether it's one I've already helped a principal deal with or not. And I, before I go home every day, I read through each of those. And as you can well imagine, some of them are pretty difficult cases.
Sure.
So oftentimes it involves me calling the administrator or the counselor back either that day or the next day to make sure that they've also followed up with law enforcement. Because in cases where there's suspected sexual abuse involved, not only is that an OCS referral, but we also require our administrators to contact law enforcement as well, because OCS and troopers or police departments they're pretty busy people, and just because we've reported it to one doesn't necessarily mean that in a timely manner they have the ability to share it. You know, OCS has the ability to coordinate with the troopers.
Sure.
So a lot of times I'm coaching folks on making sure that they're also involving law enforcement. You know, this year, as I mentioned earlier, we've seen a tremendous uptick in the number of suicide threat assessments and OCS referrals that are coming to the district level. That takes some time for us to look through each case individually to make sure that we're properly following up on everything that needs to be followed up on.
And I guess, I don't know the degree to which any of this has been studied, but maybe anecdotally, what is driving that increase? I mean, from your spot there and your experience with the district, what are some of the factors that are driving that?
Well, I think, you know, the past 3 to 4 years, we've had a pretty significant economic downturn here in Alaska. And as families have increased economic stress placed upon them because one or both parents have been laid off or are having difficulty getting a job, that stress sometimes can be manifested in the home. So I think some of it is economic. We have had a pretty dire opioid epidemic, and we're not alone here in Alaska.
Certainly not. And we're seeing that play out nationwide.
Absolutely.
And finally addressing that on some more serious levels. Yeah.
So certainly we have more parents, guardians, and individuals who are addicted to some substance or another. And I think that's one of the major, the biggest shifts that we've seen and why we're seeing more of our students in crisis and experiencing trauma.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that that part of this discussion, and especially when we're talking about adding money to the budget and adding positions and those sorts of things, part of this discussion is the question of, you know, at what point is a child's well-being the responsibility of parents and home life, and at what point is it the responsibility of schools and administrators to take care of those sorts of things? And I guess I have a pretty good idea of what your take on that would be, but you know, the idea is that it's tough to separate those two, I guess.
Somebody needs to step up and take care of a child. And in cases where it can't be the family, between the district and OCS and the foster system. That's another, we have many, many of our students that are in foster care. And unfortunately, there's not enough foster or families out there willing to be foster parents. But somebody has to step up, and we try not to let any student fall through the crack.
And, you know, we've spent so much of the program talking about some of these things that are you know, on many levels kind of worrisome and certainly very serious issues. But I did want to spend at least a few moments looking at some of the bright sides, because as we've talked about, you know, the ability to identify these things and understand the relationship between things going on at home for a student and how that affects the classroom. I also know that the graduation rates are up, that some things are being able to move in a more positive direction. And maybe you could talk about some of the success stories of how things have changed and things the district has been able to get a little bit better at addressing these things.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for going there, because it's great to start on a positive and also end on a positive.
Right.
Our graduation rate over the past 10 years has continued to get higher and higher and higher. We are significantly higher than the state of Alaska's graduation rate, and we're proud of that. But when you look at our students going on to college as well, our SAT and ACT scores, we also compare very well nationally with how our students perform on SAT and ACT. We're also very proud of our career and technical education program in the district, because we understand that not all students want to go to college and that they're going to be entering a trade. So we've done lots of work on making sure that we're providing trainings and opportunities for students to, upon graduation, be able to immediately be employable on a platform or on the North Slope or in the construction industry. So we've had lots of success with a number of industry certifications that our students are attaining before graduating. And, you know, we've got a great partnership with the KPC, Kenai Peninsula College, through UAA, and support from the borough to provide jumpstart tuition discounts for students. So we have lots of our students that are taking college courses while they're still in high school, some of which actually get close to attaining, you know, either an associate's degree or completing the first 2 years of their general education requirements for college.
That's interesting, because I guess, you know, just based on my own experience, there was some of that, I guess, that I was at least aware of. I unfortunately didn't take so much advantage of it. Is there a lot more capacity for a really driven student who's on top of things and actually somehow at 17 or 16 knows what they want to do to get pretty far? How far along can a student get in terms of their post-secondary education while they're still in their secondary education?
Great question. Pretty far.
Yeah.
If they plan in advance and are, you know, counselors are making students aware of all the options that are available to them, and our counselors do a good job at that. We have had students who have received both a high school diploma and an associate's degree from KPC at the same time. We have many students, and I'll use one of my daughters as an example. She went to college in Arizona, at Arizona State University. She was very deliberate when she was a junior and senior in which classes she was taking at KPC so that she could make sure that they transferred to Arizona State. And she was able to complete her bachelor's degree in 3 years now, and at out-of-state tuition, that was a $30,000 scholarship. And then she was immediately able to enroll into a master's program and completed that. So in 5 years, she completed, you know, her bachelor's and her master's because she had counselors and a dad who maybe knew what, you know, how she should approach certain things. She was very deliberate with which college courses she took at KPC, and we have lots of students that are doing that through the help of their counselors and their parents, so that they are saving a significant amount of money and time when they go on to college, whether in-state through the UA system or out of state.
You know, we talked about as we're kind of wrapping up here, the district's desire for some new counselors, and especially in the younger grades, would that be part of that role too, is to begin at a younger age, sort of fleshing out what are the strengths and weaknesses, what sort of areas might this student sort of gravitate to, and you can sort of begin focusing on those a little bit earlier instead of popping out of high school at 18 and having no idea?
Right. Yeah, we've been working over the past several years at starting discussions with students about potential careers and life goals in 5th, 6th, 7th grade, and ideally with more counselors in our schools, those discussions might even be able to start a little bit earlier. We never want to pigeonhole a student into being a firefighter or a nurse or, you know, a NASA scientist in 2nd grade, but I think aspirationally, letting students know that anything and everything is possible if they work hard. That's the message that we try to instill in students, and we certainly could probably do a little more of that if we had some extra help in the counseling department.
Well, we'll certainly see how that wraps up. The budget debate's continuing with just I guess about a minute or so left to go. Did we miss anything?
No, I think a great conversation. This is a topic that I am very passionate about. I'm hoping it, like I said earlier, I'm an optimist. I believe that in our continued work with the Borough Assembly, that we can convince the Borough Assembly of the need, and that this investment is not only a temporary investment, but an investment in the future of the peninsula. I'm also hopeful that our legislators from throughout the state will step up and do the right thing in terms of making sure that we don't turn the clock back on many of the successes that we've had in education in the state. We certainly have a lot of work that we need to do, and improve. There's always room for improvement. Our concern here on the peninsula is when, you know, in Juneau, people talk about how Alaska is dead last when it comes to many educational key performance indicators. That is not the case in the Kenai. Our students, if you placed our students on national, if you compared our students to the lower 48, we would perform very well. We are not last. So I just implore our community to realize that we do a great job of educating children here on the peninsula. We're not perfect, absolutely. We can always get better, but we can't get better if we're asked to do more with less.
Very good. John O'Brien with us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. He's the Assistant Superintendent of Instruction for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. John, I want to thank you so much for taking some time and being with us this morning. Good conversation. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.